reach of casual destruction, the remains of bas-relief carvings showed me glimpses of a woman's narrow face, of a dragon on the wing, of a tall and slender king. Only disconnected fragments of them remained, and I wondered if the pale woman had ordered them destroyed, or if it was merely the idle pastime of forged ones to eradicate beauty. Knowledge seeped into me slowly, but eventually I wondered, had she wished to erase all evidence that these passages had once belonged to the Elderlings? Were they the old ones that the black man had seen perish here? The corridor I followed merged seamlessly with one of ice. I stepped from black stone onto blue ice. Another dozen steps and a carved portal admitted me into an immense vaulted chamber of ice. Flowering vines of ice were carved on the massive ice pillars that had been left in place to support the blue ceiling. Time had softened their line, as the slow melt had eased them back into obscurity. But their grace remained. It was a place of dusk, a moonlit garden of ice, with a large glowing crescent moon embedded in the ceiling, and the constellations spelled out in small light orbs overhead. The woman's gardens of Buckkeep Castle would have fitted twice into this chamber. It was obviously intended as a place of beauty and peace. Yet the lower reaches of the garden, the fantastically sculpted ice fountains and the decorative benches, all showed signs of malicious vandalism. It was the sort of desecration that bespoke anger and resentment more than idleness. Only the body of a dragon poised on a pillar of ice remained. His wings had been broken away, his head shattered in a dozen pieces. The smell of old urine was strong, and the foundation pillar that supported him was corroded with yellow, as if merely destroying the dragon's image had not been enough for them. I crossed the ice gardens and found a winding stairwell that led down. At one time there had likely been carved ice stairs going down, and a balustrade, perhaps, but time and slow melt had changed the steps to an uneven and treacherous slope. I fell several times, clawing at the walls to slow my sliding and biting my cheek to endure the pain silently. The destruction in the chamber above had reminded me of the pale woman's capacity for hate. I still feared that she might lurk somewhere in this ice labyrinth. I reached the bottom bruised and discouraged. I did not want to consider how I would ascend it again. A wide corridor headed straight into a blue distance. Light globes at intervals illuminated the empty niches in its walls. As I passed them, I noted stumps of legs in one. In another, the stub of a vase remained. At one time, then, they had held sculptures, and this had been a sort of gallery, I supposed. A plain and functional side passage opened off from it, and I took it, almost relieved to leave the broken beauty behind me. I followed it for what seemed like a long time. It sloped gently down. At the next turning I went right, for I thought I knew where I was. I was wrong. The place was a warren of intersecting ice passages. Doors lined some passages, but they were frozen shut and windowless. I made my marks at junctions, but soon wondered if I would ever find my way out again. I tried always to choose the path that was more used or wider, showing the recent dirt of human usage. Evidence of that became more obvious as I worked my way ever lower into the city of ice. Such I was now certain it had been. Looking back, I wonder if the Elderlings had simply accepted and shaped the ice when it overtook the city, or if they had deliberately built in the stone of this island and then extended their dwelling into the glacier. I felt that, as I found the passages and chambers that the pale woman and her forged minions had used, I left behind the beauty and grace of the Elderlings and descended into the grubbiness and destruction of humanity. And I felt ashamed of my kind. The chambers began to show signs of recent habitation. Unemptied slop buckets stood in corners of what might have been barracks rooms. Sleeping hides were scattered on the floor amongst the casual litter of a guard room. Yet I saw none of the touches that soldiers usually kept in their sleeping places. No dice or gaming pieces, no luck charms given by their sweethearts, no carefully folded shirts set aside for an evening in the tavern. The rooms bespoke a hard and bare life, stripped of humanity. Forged. It stirred in me a fresh surge of pity for the men who had lost years of their lives in the pale woman's service. More luck than memory led me at last to her throne room. When I saw the double door, a wave of sick anticipation swept through me. That was where I had had my final glimpse of the fool. Would his chained body still sprawl on the floor there? At that thought, I felt a surge of dizziness, and for a moment blackness closed in at the edges of my vision. I halted where I stood, and breathed slowly, waiting for my weakness to pass. Then I forced my legs to carry me on. One of the tall doors of the chamber stood ajar. A shallow spill of snow and ice had been vomited out into the hall. At the sight of it, my heart stood still. Perhaps my quest would be thwarted here. The entire immense chamber collapsed and full of ice. The spilled snow was a ramp into the room. The days and nights that had passed since its collapse had seized the snow and ice in an icy grip and stilled it. Only the top third of the entry remained clear. I climbed up the fall of ice and peered into the chamber. For a moment I stood in awe in the muted bluish light. The center of the chamber ceiling had given way. Snow and ice had collapsed into it from above, filling the middle of the room, but cascading to shallowness at the edges. Light came from a few remaining globes and peered out uncertainly from beneath the fall of ice. I wondered how long those unnatural lanterns would continue to burn. Was their magic that of the pale woman, or were those too remnants of an elderling occupation of this place? I went, cautious as a rat, exploring a new room, creeping around the perimeter of the walls where the fall of ice was shallowest. I clambered up and down over chunks and drifts of ice, fearing that I would eventually find my way blocked. But I finally reached the throne end of the room and could see what remained of the pale woman's great hall. The crush of falling ice had spared that end of the chamber, its rush depleted. The wave of avalanching ice had stopped short of her throne. It was overturned and broken. But I suspected that had happened when the stone dragon had stirred to life. He seemed to have made his exit through the middle of the chamber ceiling, rather than from this end. The remains of two men protruded from the avalanche. Perhaps those were the fighters Dutiful had battled, or perhaps they had merely been in the dragon's way as he charged off to do battle. Of the pale woman, there was no sign. I hoped that she had shared their fate. The fallen and muted light globes lit this area uncertainly. All was ice and blue shadow. I circled the toppled throne and tried to remember exactly where the fool had been chained to the dragon. In retrospect, it seemed impossible that the dragon had been as immense as I recalled him. I looked in vain for fallen shackles or my friend's body. At last, I climbed up on icy rubble and from that vantage studied the room. Almost immediately, I glimpsed a swirl of familiar colours and shapes. My belly churned as I slowly clambered down and walked over to it. I stood, staring down at it, unable to feel any grief. Only burning horror and disbelief. The overlay of frost could not disguise it. At length I went to my knees, but I do not recall if I knelt to see it better, or if my shaking legs simply gave out under me. Dragons and serpents tangled and tumbled in the discarded folds of it. Scarlet frost outlined it. I did not need to touch it. I could not have brought myself to touch it. But it needed no touch to know that it was frozen solidly into the floor of the chamber. As body warmth had departed it, it had sunk into the ice and become one with it. They had flayed the tattooed skin from his back. I knelt beside it like a man in prayer. Doubtless it had been a slow and careful skinning to take it off intact. Despite the way it had wrinkled as it fell, I knew it was one continuous flap of skin, his entire back. To take it off like that would not have been easy. I did not want to imagine how they had restrained him, or who had lovingly wielded the blade. A second thought displaced that horrid image. This would not have been how she vindictively ended his life, when she realized that I had defied her and wakened the dragon. Rather, she had done this to amuse herself, at her leisure, probably beginning the slow lifting of skin from flesh almost as soon as I had been taken from the room. Flung to one side, the wrinkled layer of skin was frozen to the floor like a dirty shirt cast aside. I could not stop staring at it. I could not keep myself from imagining every slow moment of his death. This was what he had foreseen. This was the end he had dreaded to face. How many times had I assured him that I would give up my life before I saw his torn from him? Yet here I knelt, alive, Sometime later I came back to myself. I had not fainted, and I do not know where my thoughts had gone, only that I seemed to awaken from a time of utter blackness. I rose, stiffly. I would not try to free her grisly trophy and bear it off with me. That was no part of my fool. It was the cruel mark she had put upon him, his daily reminder that eventually he must come to her and yield back to her what she had etched upon his skin. So let it lie there, frozen forever. With ever-darkening hatred of her and ever-deepening grief, I knew with sudden certainty where I would find my friend's body. As I stood, I caught sight of a curved sheen of grey. It was not far from where his skin lay upon the floor. I knelt beside it and brushed a layer of frost away to reveal a blood-smeared shard of the carved rooster crown. A single gem winked up from a carved bird's eye. That I did take with me. That had belonged to him and me, and I would not leave it behind. I left the demolished room, and threaded my way through corridors as frozen as my heart. In all directions the halls looked the same, and I could not focus my mind to recall how I had been dragged to her, let alone the location of the dungeon where they had confined me. I knew now with certainty where I had to go. I needed to find my way back to the first corridor the fool and I had entered. I know it took me more than the rest of the night. I wandered until I was past weariness. The cold nudged at me, and my ears strained after imagined sounds. I saw no sign of any living creature. Eventually, when my eyes ached from remaining open, I decided to rest. I set my pack down in the corner of a small room where firewood had been stored. I put my back to the corner and sat on my pack. I clutched my sword in my hand as I drooped my head over my knees. I dozed fitfully until nightmares awoke me and drove me on again. Eventually I found her bedchamber, her frozen braziers draped with icicles. The lights burned brightly there, and I could see the whole chamber, the carved wardrobes of rich wood, and the elegant table that held her mirror and brushes, her sparkling jewelry gleaming on a silvery tree. Someone, perhaps, had plundered as he fled, for one of the wardrobes stood open and garments trailed from it across the floor. I wondered how they had missed taking the jewels. The sleek furs of her bed were hoared with frost. I did not linger there. I did not want to gaze at the empty shackles affixed to the wall across from her bed, nor on the bloody stains they framed on the icy wall. Beyond her bedchamber another door gaped. I glanced in as I passed, then halted and went back to it. There was a table in the middle of the room, and scroll racks lined the walls. They were neatly filled, the scrolls rolled and tied in the Six Duchies fashion. I walked over to them, knowing what I had found, but feeling oddly emotionless about it. I pulled out a scroll at random and opened it. Yes, it was by Master Treacney. This one had to do with rules of conduct for candidates in training. It strictly forbade the playing of pranks that involved the use of skill. I let it fall to the icy floor and chose another at random. This was newer, and I recognized Solicity's rounded hand and sloping letters. The words squirmed before my tearing eyes, and I let it fall to join its fellow. I lifted my gaze to look around the room. Here was the missing skill library of Buckkeep Castle, surreptitiously sold away by Regal to finance his lush lifestyle in Tradeford. Traders who were agents for the Pale Woman and Kebble Rawbread had brought from the youngest prince. Traders who were agents for the Pale Woman and Kebble Rawbread had bought from the youngest prince the knowledge of the Farseer magic. Our inheritance had come north, to the Out-Islanders, and eventually to this room. Here the Pale Woman had learned how to turn our own magic against us, and here she had studied how to make a stone dragon. Chade would have given his eye teeth for a single afternoon in this room. It was a treasure trove of lost knowledge. It would not buy what I most desired. A chance to do things differently. I shook my head and turned and left it there. Eventually I found the dungeons that had held the Narcheska's mother and sister. Piotr had left those doors ajar when he had snatched his women free. The next dungeon showed me a more grisly sight. Three dead men sprawled within it. I wondered if they had died as forged ones, fighting amongst themselves, or if the death of the dragon had restored them to themselves, so that they perished of cold and hunger while in full possession of their sensibilities. The door of the cell that had held Riddle and Hest stood open. Hest's plundered body lay face up on the floor. I forced myself to look down into his face. Cold and death had blackened his countenance. But I saw there still the young man I had known. After a moment's hesitation, I stooped and seized his shoulders. It was hard work, but I pried his body from the floor. It was not a pleasant task, for he was well frozen to it. I dragged him back to the room that had held the Narcheska's mother and placed him on the wooden bed. I gathered from that room and her daughter's cell anything that I thought might burn, old bedding and straw from the floor. I heaped it around his body and then sacrificed half of the flask of oil that I had brought with me for burning the fool's body. It took some little time to get a bit of the straw to light, but once it did, the flames licked eagerly at the oil and clambered over the wood and straw. I waited until a curtain of flames had risen around his body. Then I cut a lock of my hair and added it to his funeral pyre, the traditional six duchies sacrificed to say farewell to a comrade. "Not in vain, Hest. Not in vain," I told him. But as I left him burning, I wondered what we had truly accomplished. Only the years to come would tell us, and I was not yet ready to say that the freeing of the dragon was a triumph for humanity. And that left the last chamber. Of course, it would have been her final degradation of him, her final mockery and triumphant discarding of him. In a chamber spattered with human waste and garbage, by a heap of offal and filth, I found my friend. He had been alive when they dumped him here. She would have wanted him to be aware of this final indignity offered him. He had crawled to the corner of the room that was least soiled. There, huddled in a piece of dirty sacking, he had died. My fool had been such a clean man in his life that I did not doubt that dying among filth had been an additional torment for him. I do not know if someone had flung the old sacking over him, or if he had sought it himself in the time before he finally died, curled in a tight ball on the icy floor. Perhaps whoever had disposed of him here had bundled him in it to make his body easier to drag. Blood and fluids had soaked the coarse and crusty weave of the fabric, freezing it tight to his diminished body. He had drawn up his knees and tucked his chin tight to his chest, and his face was locked in an expression of pain. His gleaming hair was loose and tattered, with mats of blood in it. I set my hand on his cold, clenched brow. I had not known I was going to do it until I did it. With all the skill I could muster, I reached and sought for him. I found only stillness. I set both my hands to his cheeks and forced my way in. I explored his corpse, pushing my way through the passages where life had once flowed effortlessly. I tried to heal it, to awaken it again to life. "Go," I commanded his blood, "and live," I commanded his flesh. But his body had been still too long. Reluctantly, I learned too well what all hunters know. At the instant of death, the decay begins. The tiny bits that make up the flesh begin to slide into carrion, letting go of one another so that they can find the freedom to become other things. His blood was thick. The skin that once held out the world had become a sack that held in the separating flesh. Breathless, I pushed at it, willing life into it. But it was like pushing on a hinge rusted closed. The pieces that used to move separately had become a single unmoving entity. Function had become stillness. Other forces were at work here now, disassembling the tiniest pieces, breaking them down like grinding grain into flour. All the little links that bound them were coming undone. Nevertheless, I tried. I tried to move his arm. I tried to force his body to take breath.
"What are you doing?"
It was thick. Mildly annoyed that I had broken into his sleep. I was suddenly, frantically glad to feel him with me. "Thick, I have found him, the fool, my friend, Lord Golden. I have found him. Help me heal him. Please, lend me your strength." He was sleepily tolerant of my request.
"All right, Thick will try."
I felt the wide yawn he did not disguise.
"Where is he?"
"Here, right here." With my skill, I indicated the still body before me.
"Where?"
"Right here, here, Thick, under my hands."
"There's no one there."
"Yes, there is. I'm touching him right here. Please, Thick." Then, In my despair, I threw my plea wider. Dutiful, Chade, please, lend me strength and skill for a healing, please. Who is hurt? Not Thick. Chade was with me abruptly, full of panic.
No, I am fine. He wants to heal someone who isn't there.
He is here. I found the fool's body, Chade. Please, you all brought me back. Please, help me heal him. Help me bring him back. Dutiful spoke calmingly. Fitz, we are all here, and you know we will do this for you. It may be harder as we are separated, but we will try. Show him to us. He is here! Right here! I'm touching him! I was suddenly furiously impatient with them. Why were they being so stupid? Why wouldn't they help me?
I don't sense him, Dutiful said after a long pause. Touch him.
But I am! I bent over him and put my arms around his curled body. I'm holding him. Please, help me heal him.
That isn't a person.
Thick was obviously puzzled.
You can't heal dirt.
Rage filled me. He isn't dirt. Dutiful spoke gently. It's all right, Thick. Don't be upset. You said nothing wrong. I know you didn't mean it that way. Then to me, Fitz, oh, Fitz, I am so sorry. But he's dead. And Thick is right in his own blunt way. His body is becoming something else. I cannot sense it as a body, only as... He halted, unable to say the words. Carrion, rot, degenerating meat, dirt. Chade spoke as calmly as if he were reminding me of an obvious lesson. Healing is a function of the living body, Fitz. The skill can urge it, but the body does it when it is alive. That is not the fool you hold, Fitz. It is his empty shell. You cannot make it live any more than you could make a rock live. There is no calling him back into it. Thick spoke pragmatically.
Even if you made it work again, there's no one to put in it.
I think it finally became real then. The corpse that was no longer his body. The absence of his spirit. A long, long time seemed to pass. Then Chade spoke again softly. Fitz, what are you doing now?
Nothing. Just sitting here.
Failing. Again. Just as I did with Burrick. He died, didn't he? I could almost see the resignation on the old man's face. I knew how he would draw a breath and sigh, that I insisted on stacking all my pain in one pile, facing it all at once. Yes, he did, with his son beside him, and Webb. All of us honored him. We halted the ships to be together when they slid him over the side and let him go, just as you must let the fool go. I did not want to agree with that, or to answer it at all. The habits of a lifetime are strong. I diverted Chade's attention. I found the skill scrolls. The stolen library. It is here, in the pale woman's stronghold. Only I do not think this place was truly hers. I have seen things here that make me think it was a place where elderlings abided. Chade surprised me. Later, Fitz. Later is plenty of time to consider recovering the scrolls. For now, listen to me. Honor your friend's body, however you see fit. Release it. Then both you and Thick hurry back to the beach. I will come back on the ship that I send for you. I misjudged what you intended to do. I do not think you should be alone with this sort of grief. But he was wrong. Grief makes its own solitude, and I knew that I must endure it. I compromised, knowing it was the only way to make him leave me alone. Thick and I will be on the beach when the ship arrives. You don't need to come back for us. I won't let any harm come to us. But for now, I would be alone, if you don't mind.
No boats,
Thick said decisively.
Not ever. No. I'll stay right here where I am before I go on a boat. Forever.
Thick isn't with you now? Chade sounded anxious. No, he will explain. I still have a task to do, Chade. Thank you. All of you. Thank you for trying. I pulled up my walls, closing myself off from them. I felt Dutiful try to reach for me, but I could not tolerate even his gentle touch right then. I walled them out, even as Thick sleepily told them that the black man made wonderful food. Before my walls closed, I felt a tenuous touch that might have been nettle, trying to send me comfort. There was no comfort for me, and I would not expose her to my pain. She would have enough of her own, soon enough. I closed my walls. It was time to deal with death. I peeled the fool's corpse from the floor, leaving an outline of his coiled body and a handful of golden strands of his hair to mark where he had died. He was a solid, cold weight in my arms. In death he seemed to weigh less than he had in life, as if the departure of his spirit had taken most of him with it. I held him curled against my chest, the soiled mat of his golden hair under my chin, the coarse sacking against my fingers. I walked empty through the ice halls. We passed the chamber where Hest still burned. The smoke of his flesh crawled along the ceiling above us, tainting the still air with the aroma of cooking meat. I could have put the fool's body with his, but it did not feel right. My friend should burn alone, in a private farewell between us. I walked on past the other cell doors. After a time I became aware that I was speaking aloud to him. Where? Where would you want me to do this thing? I could place you on her bed and burn you in the midst of all her heaped wealth. Would you want that? Or would you think that contact with anything of hers would soil you? Where would I want to be burned? Under the night sky, I think, sending my own sparks up to the stars. Would you like that, fool? Or would you prefer to be within the Elderling tent, with your own things around you, closed in with the privacy you always cherished? Why didn't we ever talk about these things? It seems something a man should know about his best friend. But in the end, does it matter at all? Gone is gone. Ash is ash. But I think I would prefer to lose your smoke to the night wind. Would you laugh at me for that? Gods. Would that you could laugh at me for anything again.
How touching.
The lilt of mockery, the knife's edge of sarcasm, and the voice so like his made my heart stop and then lurch on. I slammed my skill walls tight, but felt no assault against them. I turned, teeth bared, to confront her. She stood in the door of her bedchamber. She was mantled in ermine, white fur with tiny black tails interrupting it in a scattered pattern. It hung from her shoulders to the floor, draping her entire body. Despite the richness of her garb, she looked haggard. The perfect sculpting of her face had sunken to her bones, and her pale hair, ungroomed, lagged and wisped like dry straw around her face. Her colourless eyes seemed almost dull, the eyes of a beached fish. I stood before her, clutching the fool's corpse to my breast. I knew he was dead and she could no longer hurt him, and yet I backed away from her, as if I still needed to protect him from her. As if I had ever been able to protect him from her. She lifted her chin, baring the white column of her throat.
"Drop that,"
she suggested,
"and come and kill me."
Was it because she had suggested it that my first thought now seemed like such a bad idea? "No," I replied, and suddenly I wanted only to be left completely alone. This was an intimate death, I held. She, of all people, should not witness or take satisfaction in my grief. "Go away," I said, and did not know the low growl of my own voice. She laughed, icicles shattering on stone.
"Go away? Is that all? Go away? Such a keen vengeance for Fitzchivalry Farcia to take upon me? Ah, that shall go down in tales and songs." And then he stood holding his beloved and said to their enemy, "Go away."
She laughed, but there was no music in it. It was like rocks rattling down a hillside, and when I made no response to it, her laughter trailed away into silence. She stared at me, and for a moment she looked confused. She had truly believed that she could make me drop him and attack her. She tipped her head, staring at me, and after a moment spoke again. Her voice was lower now.
"Wait, I see. You have not yet unwrapped my little gift for you. You have not yet seen all that I did to him.
Wait until you see his hands and those clever, graceful fingers of his. Oh, and his tongue and teeth that spoke so wittily for your amusement. I did that for you, Fitzchivalry, that you might fully regret your disdainful rejection of me. She paused very briefly, and then said, as if reminding me, Now, Fitz, this is when you promise to kill me if I follow you. I had been about to utter those words. I bit down on them. She had made them empty and childish. Perhaps those words were always empty and childish. I shifted my burden in my arms and then turned and walked away from her. My skill walls were up and tight, but if she made any assault against them, it was too subtle for me to feel. My back felt exposed, and I'll admit that I wanted to run. I asked myself why I did not kill her. The answer seemed too simple to be true. I did not want to put his body down on her floor while I did it. Even more, I did not want to do anything she expected me to do.
He called out for you,
she sang the words after me.
He thought he was close to dying, I imagine. Of course he was not. I am more adept than that. But he thought the pain would kill him, and he cried out for you. Beloved! Beloved!
Her mockery of his agonized voice was perfect. The hair on the back of my neck stood up, as if he had spoken to me from beyond the grave. Despite my resolve, my steps slowed. I held his body closer and bowed my head more tightly over his. I hated that her words could bring tears to my eyes. I should kill her. Why didn't I kill her?
He did mean you, did he not? Well, of course he did, though you may not know it. I doubt you know the custom of the people he came from, how they exchange names to denote the lifelong bonds they form. Did you ever call him by your name, to show him that he was as dear to you as your own life? Did you? Or were you too much of a coward to let him know?
I wanted to kill her then, but I would have had to set his body down, and I would not do that. She could not make me abandon him again. I would not set him down, and I would not look back at her. I hunched my back against her pelted words and trudged away.
Did you? Did you? Did you?
I had expected to hear her voice fade as I walked away. Instead, she lifted it, and her tone became even angrier as she flung the hateful question at me. After a time, I knew she was following me. The words were a hoarse shriek now, the cawing of crows as they summon one another to the rich pickings of a battlefield.
Did you? Did you? Did you?
Even when I heard her running footsteps behind me and knew that she would attack me, I could not bring myself to drop the fool's body. I held him and turned, hunching a shoulder to her maddened onslaught. I do not think it was what she expected. Perhaps she had hoped I would face her with a drawn blade. She tried to stop, but the icy floor betrayed her. She slid into me. I kept my grip on the fool's body as I slammed against the wall and somehow managed to stay on my feet. She did not. She sprawled on her side, gasping hoarsely in her pain. I looked at her dumbly, wondering how a fall could have caused her that much agony. Then, as she tried to rise, I saw what she had concealed from me. Riddle's telling had been true. I stared at the blackened and shriveled forearms that she struggled to use. She could neither rise nor cover them again beneath the robe. I met her colourless eyes and spoke my words coldly. You are the coward. At the last minute you could not give up yourself, not even to complete your vision of what the world should be. You lacked his courage. He accepted the price fate decreed for him. He took his pain and his death, and he won. He triumphed. You failed. She made a sound between a shriek and a yelp, full of hatred and fury. It battered at my skill wall, but she could not get through. Had her strength for that magic been drawn from Kebble Rawbread? I watched her try to get to her feet. The long mantle hindered her, for she knelt on the hem of it. The black sticks that had been her arms and hands were of no use to her. From the elbow down, her arms were shrunken to bones that ended in charred and tapering ends. I could see the remains of the jewel bones in her forearms. There was no sign of her hands and fingers. Those, at least, the dragon had claimed before she had managed to drag herself free of him. I recalled how Verity had gone, and Kettle, melting into the dragon they had fashioned so lovingly for the good of their people. Then I turned and walked away from her.
"Stop!"
she commanded me. There was outrage in her voice.
"You kill me here! I have seen this 100 times in my nightmares! You kill me now! It was my certain fate if I failed. I dreaded it, but I now command it. My visions have always been true. You are fated to kill me."
I spoke over my shoulder, scarcely considering my words at all. "I am the catalyst. I change things. Besides, the time we are in now is the time the fool chose. It is his future I live in. In his vision of the future, I walk away from you. You die slowly. Alone." Another 12 steps, and then she screamed. She screamed until her breath was gone, and then I heard her ragged panting. I walked on.
"You are the catalyst still,"
she shrieked after me. There was nothing but desperation and amazement in her voice now.
"If you will not kill me, then come back and use your skill to heal me. I will be subject to you in all ways. You could use me as you wished, and I could teach you all I have learned from the skill scrolls. You have the strength to wield that magic. Heal me, and I will show you the path to power. You will be the rightful king of the 6 duchies, of the out islands, of all the cursed shores. All. I will give you all your dreams if only you come back."
My dream was dead. My dream was dead in my arms. I continued to walk. I heard her scratching the blackened stubs of her melted arms against the ice. It reminded me of an overturned beetle frantically scrabbling in a washbasin. I did not look back. I wondered briefly if she had ever foreseen this moment, if she had ever imagined the look of my back as I walked away. No, I suddenly knew. The black man had told me. I walked in the fool's world now, the future he had shaped. She could see nothing, prophesy nothing here. This time was not hers. It was the time he had chosen. I do not think I am by nature a cruel man, and yet I have never been able to feel any sort of compunction over what I did. I heard her scream once, like an animal screams from a trap, but I did not look back. I turned a corner and walked on, back the way I had come. I was unutterably weary, and cold, and hungry. Yet none of those things consumed me as much as my grief. At some point tears came to me. They fell on the fool's golden hair and misted my vision of the tunnels to a pale maze. Perhaps in my daze I missed one of my marks on the wall. I realized it and turned back, but found myself in an unfamiliar corridor. I came to an eroded ice staircase and attempted to go up it, but found that burdened as I was, I could not. I turned back again and trudged on, hopelessly lost. At one point, I spread my cloak out on the floor and slept for a time, my arm flung protectively across his frozen body. When I awoke, I searched through my pack and found a bit of traveler's bread and ate it. I drank from my flask and then wet the edge of my cloak and wiped some of the blood and filth from his contorted face. I could not wipe the pain from his brow. Then I rose and took him up and walked on, completely disoriented in the unchanging pale light. I was, perhaps, a trifle mad. I reached a place where one wall was of ice and one of stone. I should have turned back, but like a moth drawn toward light, I followed the passageway that was leading me upwards. I came to stairs cut in the stone and followed them up. The bluish light of the gleaming orbs did not waver, never brightening or dimming, so that I bore his body through a timeless maze of gentle stairs that wound ever upwards. I halted for breath on a landing. There was a wooden door there, the wood gone splintery and dry. I pushed it open, thinking of finding fuel for his burning. If I had doubted at all that once this icy realm had belonged to the Elderlings, that chamber dispelled it. I had seen furniture like this before, tottering in the deserted ruins of the city by the river. I had seen a map such as this room held, though this seemed to be of a world rather than of a city in the surrounding countryside. It was on a table in the center of the room. It was round, but it was not flat, nor drawn upon paper. Each island, each coast, each wave tip had been sculpted. Tiny mountains jutted in ranges, and the sea crinkled. Gleaming rivers meandered through grasslands to the sea. An island, most likely Aslivyal, was in the exact center of it. Other islands dotted the sea around it. To the south and west I saw the coast of the six duchies, though it was subtly wrong in many places. To the north was a land I had no name for, and across a wide sea on the eastern edge of the map I saw a coastline where tradition told me there was only endless ocean. Tiny gems had been set randomly into the map, each marked with a rune. Some seemed to glow with an inner light. One glittered white on Aslivyal. Four, set in a minute square, sparkled in Buck, near the mouth of the Buck River. There were a handful of others, throughout the six duchies, some bright and some dull. There were more in the mountain kingdom, and a line of them carefully spaced along the Rainwild River, though many of those were quenched. I nodded slowly to myself. Of course. Dimly I was aware that my arms and back ached, yet it never occurred to me that I might wish to set down my burden and rest for a time. Inevitable as sunset, there was the door to another stairwell in the corner. I entered it. It was narrower than the first, and the stairs were steeper. I marched slowly up it, my feet scuffing as I found each step unseeing. The light changed slowly as I went. The bluish glow faded, slowly replaced with the murky light of true day. Then I emerged into a tower room walled with glass. One panel of it had cracked, and all of the windows were coated with frost. The ceiling spoke of a steep spire overhead, with sheltering eaves. I put my eye to the crack in the window and peered out. Snow. Blowing snow. I could see no more than that. In the center of the room was a skill pillar. The runes carved into the sides of it were as cleanly chiseled as the day they had been cut. I walked a slow circuit around them until I came to the one that I had known would be there. I nodded to myself. I held him close to me and said softly into his blood-matted hair, "Let's go back, then." I opened one hand and we walked into the skill pillar. Perhaps my recent practice of the skill had strengthened me, or perhaps this pillar worked better than others I had known. The fool in my arms, I stepped from winter to summer, from a stone tower to what remained of a market plaza. All around me a summer day hummed in the forest that had encroached to the edges of it. I took two more steps and then went to my knees, both in weakness and gratitude. Here, suddenly, it did not feel like blasphemy to deposit him on the clean stone and earth. I sat down flat beside him and rested. For a time, all was still, save for the calls of birds and the buzzing of busy insects. I looked down the overgrown road, like a tunnel through the greenery of the forest, that would, if I followed it, lead me to the stone garden where all the elderling dragons slept. I looked up at the worn pillar, where once a young fool had perched, and I had seen him transformed into a white girl wearing a rooster crown. "This is a good place," I said softly. "I'm glad we came back here." I leaned back and closed my eyes. I slept. It took time for the warmth of the afternoon to seep into me. When I awoke, I was too warm. The fool's frozen body was thawing and loosening in the sunlight. I peeled my winter garments from my body as if I were shedding an outworn skin until I wore only my tunic and leggings. Now that we were here, alone and together, I felt my urgency leave me. There was time here, time that belonged only to him and me, time in which I could do things properly. I fetched water from the stream where once we had drunk. I gently washed his face, wiping the blood from his lips and smoothing the hair over his torn ear. When I could do so, I peeled the sacking away from his raw flesh. What I saw dizzied me at first. Yes, she was right. I did regret that I had turned away from her instead of dealing her the agonizing death she deserved. But as I straightened as much as I could his tormented and stiffened limbs and wiped away with green leaves and clean grass the filth and clotted blood, all hatred seeped away from me. Here was my fool, and if I could not save him from death, I could send him from this life with dignity. He had curled protectively around his last treasure. He gripped the rooster crown in his lifeless hands. I pried its dull grey wood carefully from his nailless fingers. His tormentors had broken the crown, probably in the course of beating him, but he had repaired it before he died. When I saw how he had done it, how he had used his own congealing blood as a binder to hold the pieces together, I choked for a time. Its circle had a gap in it. I wondered if that had grieved him as he died. Slowly I took from my pouch the shard they had left on the floor of the throne room. It only lacked that one piece to make it complete. I dipped the edges of it into his thawing blood, and joined it to its fellows to complete the crown. Damped with blood, the wood swelled and seized and held, almost as if it had never been broken. I did not know what this treasure was exactly. Whatever it had meant to him, I would send him from this world wearing it. I set it to one side as I gathered evergreen boughs and dry fallen limbs, dead twigs and dry grasses for his funeral pyre. Evening was hovering before it was built. When it was ready, I spread my cloak over it. Overhead a deep blue sky shimmered, and summer seemed to hold its breath around us, awaiting the first stars of evening. The sparks of his burning would join them. I lifted him and placed him on the cloak. Experience told me the evergreen boughs would burn well and consume him. With a heavy heart I sat down on the stone beside his pyre, the rooster crown in my lap. It lacked but one thing to be complete. From my pack I took a bundled packet. Gently I unrolled the fabric. One at a time I set out the feathers from the other's beach. As I handled each one, I marvelled anew at the intricate workmanship that had gone into their carving. Despite all the long way they had travelled with me, they were unharmed. Why someone had chosen such a lustreless wood for such fine work escaped me. It was as plain and dull as the arrow the fool had given Swift. It took some moments for me to fit each feather into its proper place. I noticed now what I never had before, that the end of each feather's shaft was notched. Each would slide only into its proper aperture in the crown. As I pushed the last one into place, it seemed to my weary eyes that a wave of colours washed over both crown and feathers. Perhaps it was only a rainbow caught for an instant in the sudden tears that brimmed my eyes. I dashed them away impatiently. Time to be done with all this. The crown whispered uncomfortably against my fingers, like a trapped fly buzzing in a fist. I wondered what I held. What potent elderling magic was trapped here, denied for all time by the fool's death? For a moment my eyes lingered on the softened carvings of roosters' heads that ringed the crown. Either the fool had never got round to painting it as we recalled it, or it had refused to hold the paint. Chips of colour still clung to the deeper corners of the carving. Tiny gems still winked in two of the carved eyes. The others were blank and empty. There were dark seams in the ring of the crown, where it had been broken and then glued back into a hole with the fool's blood. I tapped one of the seams cautiously, testing the strength of the bond. It held, and suddenly he leapt into my mind, my memory of him so poignant and whole, that I felt disemboweled with sorrow. I sat down heavily on the pyre beside him. Rigor had kept his body in its defensive curl. I could do nothing about that. I wished that I could have smoothed the lines of terror and pain from his face before I sent him on his way. I pushed his golden hair back from his tawny forehead. "Oh, beloved," I said. I bent and kissed his brow in farewell. And then, grasping the rightness of that foreign tradition, I named him as myself. For when I burned him, I knew I would be ending myself as well. The man I had been would not survive this loss. Goodbye, Fitzchivalry Farseer. I took the crown in both hands to ease it onto his brow. I felt suddenly as if all my life had been funneling me toward this moment. It seemed cruel that the strongest current of my life would propel me towards this moment of absolute end and loss. But there were no other choices left for me. Some things could not be changed. It was time to crown the king's jester. and send him on his way. I stopped. I halted my hands, and it felt as if by doing so I stood alone against fate and defied the flow of all time. I knew what I was meant to do. I should crown my fool and then drench the pyre with the remaining oil. A spark, at most two, would be enough for the summer dry tinder. He would burn away to nothing. His smoke rising on the summer wind of the land beyond the mountain kingdom, I would go back, through the pillar, to Aslevial. I would collect thick and go back to the little bay and wait for a ship to come and fetch us. It was right. It was inevitable. It was the channel in which the entire world wished to flow. Life would go on without the fool because he had died. I could see it all so clearly, as if I had always known it would come to this. He was dead. Nothing could change that. But I was the changer. I stood suddenly. I lifted the humming crown high overhead in my hands and shook it at the sky. No! I roared. I still do not know to whom I spoke. No! Let it be different. Not this way. Whatever you want from me, take it, but don't let it all end like this. Let him take my life and give me his death. Let him be me and I be him. I take his death. Do you hear me? I take his death for my own. I lifted the crown to the sun. Through my flowing tears it shone iridescent, and the feathers seemed to waver gently in the summer breeze. Then, with an almost physical wrench, I tore it out of time's destined path. I clapped it firmly upon my own brow. As the world spun around me, I lay my body down on my funeral pyre, wrapped my arms around my friend, and gave myself over to whatever awaited me beyond it. Chapter 29. Feathers in a Fool's Cap. She was the richest girl in the world, for not only had she a noble father, and many silk gowns and so many necklaces and rings that not even a dozen little girls could have worn them all at once, but she had also a little grey box, carved from a dragon's womb. And inside it, ground to fine powder, were all the happy memories of the wisest princesses who had ever lived. So whenever she got the least bit sad, all she had to do was open her little box and take a tiny bit of the memory snuff and ka-choo! She was as happy as a girl could be again. Old Jamalian Tale. I missed a step in the dark. It was like that. That unexpected lurch. Blood is memory. I swear someone whispered that by my ear. Blood is who we are, a young woman agreed with him. Blood recalls who we were. Blood is how we will be remembered. Work it well into the womb wood. Someone laughed, an old woman with few teeth. Say that 6 times swiftly, she cackled, and she did. Work it well into the womb, 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 would. The others laughed, amused at her tripping tongue. Well, you try it, she challenged us. Work it well into the womb, would, I said, obediently. But it wasn't me. There were 5 other people there inside me, looking out of my eyes, running my tongue over my teeth, scratching at my beard with my unkempt nails, breathing my breath, and rejoicing in the taste of the forest on the night air, shaking out my hair alive again. 5 poets, 5 jesters, 5 tellers of tales, 5 jumbling, tumbling minstrels, leaping and whirling in gratitude for their release, shaking out my fingers, limbering my voice, and already squabbling and vying for my attention. What is your need? A birthday anthem? I've a host of them at my beck and call, and it's no trouble, no trouble at all to adapt one to your recipient's name. Hackery! Shameless hackery! This chopping and slicing of old relics! This dressing of bones anew!
Let me have your voice, and I'll sing you a song to rouse your warriors and make your maidens tremble with new-born lust."
This was a man, and he filled my lungs to bursting to roar out his words. Each set of words, each voice, came from my own throat. I was a puppet for them, a pipe to be played.
"Lust is but a wet moment, a surge and a splat," she said disdainfully.
She was a young woman, and she remembered freckles across the bridge of her nose. Strange to hear her words pipe from my throat.
"You want a love song, don't you? Something timeless, something older than the fallen mountains, and newer than a seed unfurling in rich soil. Such is love."
"Good luck," someone exclaimed in dismay. He tinged his words with a fop's disdain. "Listen. Fa-la-la-la-la-la. Oh, hopeless. This one has the pipes of a sailor and a body of wood. The finest song ever sung will be a crow's croaking when it comes from this throat, and I'll wager he never turned a handspring in his life.
Who is this, and how came he by our treasure?"
"Minstrels," I said dully. "Minstrels, tumblers, and bards. Oh, fool, this would be your treasure, a circle of jesters. There is no help for us here."
I put my head down into my hands. I felt the rough wood of the crown beneath my fingers. I pushed at it, but it clung stubbornly in place. It had tightened to my brow.
"We've only just arrived," the toothless crone complained. "We've no intention of leaving already. We are a great gift, a magnificent gift, only awarded to the one most pleasing to the king. We are a chorus of voices. From all ages, we are a rainbow of history. Why would you refuse us? What sort of a performer are you?"
"I'm not a performer at all," I sighed heavily. For a moment, I regained full awareness of my body. I stood by the funeral pyre. I didn't recall getting up from it. Night was dark around us, and chirring insects were tuning their voices. In the cooling air, I smelled the rich leaf mould of the forest. The fool's degenerating body added its own note of sweet rot. All his life he had been the scentless one to Night Eyes. Now in death I smelled him. It did not sicken me. There was still wolf enough in me that how he smelled was simply how he smelled. It was the change that gave me a pang, for it was irrefutable evidence that his body was going back to the earth and the natural web of rot and rebirth all around me. I tried to pause for long enough to take some comfort in that, but the five within me were too impatient for stillness. They turned me in a slow circle, lifting my arms, testing the spring of my feet, filling my lungs with air. I sensed how those within me lapped eagerly at the night, the taste, the smell, the sound, and the feel of the forest air on my face. They were avid for life.
"What help do you need?"
the freckled girl asked me, and in her voice I heard sympathy and a readiness to listen. And under it, scarcely cloaked, lurked the hunger that all minstrels have for the tale of another's woe. She wanted that part of life back as well. I did not wish to share mine. "No, go away. You can't help me." And then, against my will, I told them anyway. "My friend is dead. I want to bring him back to life. Can a minstrel help with that?" For one respectful instant, they were silent, as I gazed down on the fool's corpse. Then the freckle-nosed girl said tremulously,
"He's very dead, isn't he?"
"Yes, he is," the bull-throated one declared, but added, "I can make you such a song as will have him remembered 1,000 years hence. It is the only way ordinary mortals can transcend the flesh. Give me your memories of him and I'll get started."
The crone spoke sense to me.
"Did we know how to undo death, would we be what we are, feathers in a fool's cap? We are lucky to have this much of life left to us. A pity that your friend did not have the favour of a dragon, or perhaps he too could share this boon."
"What are you?" I demanded.
"We are the sweet preserves of song, stored away so that in the winter of our deaths you can taste again the tang of our summers."
It was the young man, so conscious of his imagery that he ruined it for me.
"Someone else," I begged, when the young man fell silent.
"We were favored of dragons,"
a calm voice said. She was one who had not spoken before. Her voice was a deep, calm pond, huskier than the voice of most women. I heard it in my mind even as my own throat rusted her words.
I lived by the river of black sand in a little town called Junket. I went one day to fetch water from the river, and there I met my dragon. She was a young thing, just at the end of her first summer, and I was in the spring of my years. Oh, she was green, a thousand greens, with eyes like deep pots of melted gold. She stood in the river and the waters rushed by her. Then she looked at me, and my heart fell into her whirlpool eyes, never to surface again. I had to sing to her. Speaking would not have been enough. So she charmed me, and I sang to her, and charmed her in return. I was her minstrel, and her bard for all the days of my life. And when my time to end was approaching, she came to me with the gift that only a dragon may give. It was a sliver of wood from a dragon's womb. Do you know of whereof I speak? The cradles they spin for the serpents to sleep in until they emerge as dragons. Sometimes there is one who does not survive that stage, who dies in the sleep between serpent and dragon. Slow is the womb wood to erode, and the dragons forbid that humans touch any of it, save by their leave. But to me, fair Smokewing brought a sliver of it. She bid me wet it well with my own blood, and work the blood into it with my fingers, all the while thinking of a feather. I knew what such a favor meant. It was rarely granted, even to minstrels who had served their dragons well. It meant I would take a place in the crowd of minstrels so that my songs and words and my way of thinking would go on long after I died. The crown is the property of the ruler of all the riverlands. The ruler alone declares who may wear the crown and sing with the voices of minstrels long dead. It is a great honor, for only a dragon can select you to become a feather, and only the ruler can bestow the gift of wearing the crown. Such an honor! I remember how I clasped my feather as I died. For die I did, just like your friend. A pity that your friend was not favored of dragons to have been granted such a boon.
I was hammered by the irony of it. He should have been. He died to waken a dragon, the last male dragon in the world, so that Icefire might rise to partner Tintaglia, the last female, so that there might be dragons again in this world. The moment of silence told me I had impressed them.
Now here is a tale worth the telling. Give us the memories of that, and each of us will make you a song, for surely there are at least a score of songs in such an event.
It was the crone who spoke, my mouth going soft with her words. But I don't want a song about him. I want the fool as he was, alive and whole.
Dead is dead,
the bull-voiced man said, but he said it gently.
If you wish to open your memories to us, we will weave you songs. Even with your voice, they will be songs that will live, for true minstrels will hear you sing them, and wish to sing them as they should be sung. Do you want to do that?
No, please, Fitz, no. Leave it be. Let it be over.
It was a whisper against my senses, scarce a breathing of the words. I shivered to it, wild with hope and fear. Fool, I breathed, praying there would be some response. Instead there was a cacophony, the thoughts indistinguishable from one another, as the five feather minstrels all shouted a dozen unanswerable questions at me. At last, Bullthroat roared through them with a reply.
He's here, with us, in the crown of all places. He put his blood in the crown.
But from the fool there was no reply. I spoke for him. The crown was broken. He used his blood to mend it.
The crown was broken?
The crone was aghast.
It would have ended all of us. Forever.
He cannot stay in the crown. He was not chosen. Besides, the crown belongs to all of us. If he takes it, we shall not be able to speak, save through him.
The young man was outraged at the fool's rash assumption of his territory.
He must go,
the bull-voiced man concluded.
We are very sorry, but he must go. It is not right nor fitting that he be here.
He was not chosen. He was not invited.
He is not welcome.
They gave me no time to express an opinion. The crown was tight to my brow, and suddenly it became tighter. I lifted my hands to it, for they seemed to have retreated from my body into the crown, to do whatever they were doing now. For the nonce, my body was my own again. I tried to tear the crown from my head, but I could not get so much as a nail between it and my skin. In a wave of horror, I realized it was melding to my flesh, melting into me like a coterie seeping into a stone dragon.
No!
I roared. I shook my head and clawed at it. It would not budge. Worse, it no longer felt like wood beneath my fingers. It felt like a band of flesh. When I queasily lifted my fingers to investigate the feathers, they flexed softly as cockerel plumes against my fingers. I felt sick. Trembling, I went back to the funeral pyre and sank down onto it beside the fool. I sensed no battle in the crown, only a concerted effort by the five minstrels. The fool did not resist them. He simply did not know how to do what they demanded of him. I no longer had any voice in what they did. Theirs was a quarrel heard across the market, a conflict I was aware of but had no part in. They would force him out of the crown, and then he would be truly gone, forever. I could not stop it. I took his body in my lap and held it. It had passed through stiffness now to laxness. His hand flopped to one side, and I lifted it by the wrist to fold it back into his chest. Something in the way it moved so lifelessly woke an ancient memory. I scowled after it. It was not my recall. It was Night Eyes, and he saw it through a wolf's eyes. We were in hunting light, and the colours were muted, yet I had been there, somehow. And then it came back to me. The grey one, Chade, leaning on a shovel, his breath white in the cold air. He stands some distance away so as not to frighten us. Heart of the Pack is the one who sits on the edge of my grave. His feet dangle in the hole before him, my splintered coffin at his feet. He holds my corpse in his lap. He waves the hand of it at me, beckoning the wolf in closer. His wit is strong, and Night Eyes cannot bring himself to disobey Heart of the Pack. Heart of the Pack is speaking to us, a steady stream of calm words. Come back to this. This is yours, Changer. Come back to it. Night Eyes lifts a lip and snarls. We know death when we smell it. That body is dead. It is carrion, not fit for an honest meal. Night Eyes conveys the message to Heart of the Pack. It smells bad. It is spoiled meat. We do not want it. There is better meat by the pond than that. Come closer, Burrick bids us. For that moment I perceive him as both Burrick and Heart of the Pack. I slide sideways from the wolf's perception of him into my human memory of that moment. I had long suspected that I had truly died, despite Chade's assurances that his poisons had only feigned my death. My body had been too battered to withstand any amount of poison. In the memory, my wolf's nose is mercilessly truthful. That body was dead. But the wolf's keener wit awareness tells me what I had never guessed before. Heart of the Pack does more than hold my flesh. He has prepared it for me. It is ready to begin again, if only he can coax me into it. Night Eyes is a reassuring whisper against my senses. The wit, not the skill. Burrick did it with the wit. But he was much stronger in that magic than I was, and far more wise. I stroked the fool's slackening face, willing his body to align with mine, but I could not find a way into him. He did not have the wit. Was that the difference? I did not know. But I knew that there was a way, once, a place where we had linked, he and I. Once he had dragged me from the wolf's body back into my own. I turned my own wrist up to the faltering moonlight and found there the duskiness of his fingerprints. I took his mangled hand in mine. The fingernails had been peeled from three of his slender, delicate fingers. I pushed away my awareness of that agony he had endured. My hand overshadowed his as I carefully set each fingertip of his to each print on my wrist. I groped for the slender skill link spun between us so many years before. And it was there, faint as gossamer, but there. I gathered my courage, knowing well that I was going into death itself. But go I would. Had not I just said that I would take his death for him? I could feel that the crown minstrels were forcing him out, expelling him into my own flesh, but I had no time to wait and make explanations for him. I took a deep breath and trickled down the skill link, leaving my body to his awakening awareness and entering the ruin of his. For the briefest moment, my perception was doubled. The fool was in my flesh, looking out of my eyes. He stared down aghast at his own lax corpse in my arms. He lifted a hand to touch my whiskered chin.
"Beloved,"
he groaned.
"Oh, beloved, what have you done? What have you done?"
"It's all right," I assured him quietly. "It's all right. If I fail, take my life and live it. I willingly take your death." I seeped away from my body. Then, like a stone falling into muck, I sank into the fool's lifeless flesh. I was in a body that was dead, that had been dead for days. This body had no life left in it, and hence it was no longer a body, lifeless as a rock. It was separating into its components and going back to the earth. My skill did not know what to make of such a situation. I pushed aside my impulse to use it, to cry out to Thick and Chade and Dutiful. They would only have forced me back into my own body to save me. The wit is the awareness of life all around us. It is a web, a net that connects us to every living creature. Some were vital and complex, large, healthy beasts that demanded my recognition. Trees and plants were subtler, but even more essential to the continuation of life than creatures that moved. They were the warp the world is woven upon, and without them we would all snarl and fall. Even so, I had successfully ignored them for most of my life, other than a passing interest in the green shadow life of the oldest trees. But beyond and beneath it all, there flowed an even more nebulous life. It was death. Death, the knots in the net that connected us all, was not death at all. In that twisting and tightening noose, life was reformed, not destroyed. The fool's body rioted with life. It was a simmering cauldron of life, bubbling its way to rebirth. Every element that had united to make his body a living creature was still there. The question was, could I persuade it to assume its old alignment rather than the simpler forms it was now reducing itself to? Breathless, voiceless, senseless, I gave myself over to it. It was like a skill stream in its own way, for it plucked and tugged at the strings of the fool's body, carrying away bits of him that it would use elsewhere. It fascinated me, this orderly dispersal, this resorting and reordering. It was rather like watching a well-played game of stones. The bits moved in a pattern. I tried to coax one back to its old position, but it flowed away from me to join its fellows.
"It's the old game again. Still you will not see it. They are not individual hunters, but a pack. You do not set your will against the individuals. There are too many of them. You cannot stop them. So drive them. Use them. What they have made new, put back in place of the old."
It was a wolf's wisdom. As Black Rolf had told me it could be, so it was. Night Eyes was with me. Not as he had been, but as we had been. It was his vision I used that night, his simple wolf's awareness that when one ate meat, one ate life as much as flesh. The elegant balance of the predator and the prey applied here as much as it did when we had hunted together. Death feeds life. What the body takes apart, it assembles again. This was not a skill healing. It was a guiding of the changes, a herding of the bits into alignment I recalled. I doubt that I was as adept as Burrick had been in my restoration. Time and again the flows I had corrected reversed themselves and had to be persuaded again to build up, not tear down. Nor was the fool completely human. That night I confronted completely his strangeness. I thought I had known him. In those hours of rebuilding I realized and accepted him as he was. That in itself was a revelation. I had always believed we were more alike than different. It simply was not true. He was human only in the same way that I was a wolf. I stayed with my work, past the moment when I felt the blood begin to once more flow within his veins, beyond the slow perception that I could once more draw breath into his lungs. Some of his body had been repaired in the act of restoring it. Two of his ribs had been broken. Those bone ends had found their mates and began knitting themselves together. Gossamer stitches of flesh closed the worst rents in his skin, but there was little I could do about the places where the flesh or bone or nail was simply missing. Delicately, I set in motion his own healing. I dared not urge it much past its own careful reconstruction. He had already burned the reserves of his body. I closed the raw flesh of his back against the agonizing kiss of the air. I coaxed his split tongue into a hole again. Two of his teeth were missing, and there was nothing I could do about that. When I knew I had done all I could for his body, I drew a deeper breath into his lungs. I opened his eyes. Night was fading into dawn. The weaker stars had already given way to the creeping light of day. A bird sang a dawn call. Another one challenged it. An insect hummed past my ear. I became aware of my body more slowly. Blood moved through me, and I tasted air sliding from my lungs. It was good. There was pain, a great deal of pain, but pain is the body's messenger, the warning that something is wrong and must be repaired. Pain says that you are still alive. I heeded that message and reveled in it. For a long time, it seemed enough. I blinked my eyes and shifted my gaze. Someone cradled me in his arms. His arm beneath my raw back was a scarlet welt of agony, but I lacked the strength to move away from it. I looked up into my own face. It was different from seeing myself in a mirror. I was older than I thought. He had taken off the crown, but there was a standing welt on my brow where it had scored my flesh with its grip. My eyes were closed, and tears from beneath the closed lids slid down my cheeks. I wondered why I wept. How could anyone weep on such a dawn? With great effort, I lifted one hand slowly and touched my own face. My eyes snapped open, and I stared at them in wonder. I had not known they were so dark, nor that they could be so wide. I looked down at myself, incredulously. "Fitz?" The inflection was the fool's, but the hoarse voice was mine. I smiled. "Beloved?" His arms closed around me, almost convulsively. I arched away from that pain, but he seemed unaware of it. Sobs shook him. "I don't understand," he wailed to the sky. "I don't understand." He looked around, my face wild with his uncertainty and fear. "I have never seen this moment. I am out of my time, beyond where I ended. What has happened? What has become of us?" I tried to move, but I had so little strength. For a time, I had to ignore his weeping while I assessed myself. There was a lot of damage, but the body was striving to repair. I felt terribly, terribly frail. I drew a breath and told him quietly, "The skin on my back is new and tender yet." He gulped for air. Breath ragged, he protested, "But I died. I was in that body, and they've sliced the skin free from my back. I died." His voice cracked on the words. "I remember it. I died." "It was your turn to die," I agreed. "And my turn to bring you back." "But how? Where are we?" "No, I know where. But when? How can we be here, alive? How can we be like this?" "Be calm," I had the fool's voice. I tried for his lilt of amusement and almost found it. "All will be well." I found my wrist with his hand. The fingertips knew where to fall. For a moment our gazes held as we mingled in unity. One person. We had always been one person. Night Eyes had voiced it long ago. It was good to be whole again. I used our strength to pull myself up, to press his brow to mine. I did not close his eyes. Our gazes locked. I felt my frightened breath against his mouth. "Take your body back from me," I bid him quietly. And so we passed, one into the other. But for a space, we had been one. The boundaries between us had melted in the mingling. "No limits," I recalled him saying, and suddenly understood. No boundaries between us. Slowly I